From the very wet heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Dr. Bruce Goldberg joins us, exploring the fifth dimension. Here's what's happening. At this moment, a number of suspects have been cornered in a building in a Paris suburb. Witnesses have reported gunfire amid police raiding the northern Paris suburb area there as authorities hunt for two suspects from Friday's deadly terrorist attacks. These people are believed to be on the run. Police officers have been wounded apparently by the gunfire during this raid. And of course, 129 people killed, many others wounded during Friday's horrible tragedy there. And as Congress and America's governors debate whether to allow more Syrian refugees to come into the country, already 2,000 have been admitted since the start of the 2011 Syrian civil war. And in a case or two, they have no idea where an individual is. They don't know where he went. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, with us. First of all, John, I wanted to get your reaction to the tragedy in Paris. Have not had a chance to talk with you about that.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, the tragedy in Paris happened in the United States 6 years ago under Obama's first, year of his presidency, when Nidal Hassan, massacred 13 soldiers at Fort Hood, and the administration denied that there was any terrorist connection. Of course, after they had reviewed the emails, they found out that he was radicalized by Anwar Awlaki, the head of the Al-Qaeda's Yemen cell. We had the Boston Marathon bombing. What's happened in Paris, obviously, and I think Brennan, the CIA director, yesterday said it's very likely that another incident like this will happen in Washington or New York or somewhere in the States. The problem with the White House, the tragedy of it all, and it's, horrific to see people massacred in the streets like this, is that, you hark back to this, George, you go back to 1998, and you remember Bill Clinton basically shooting missiles off randomly, supposedly at Osama bin Laden, after the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Nairobi, Kenya were in Dar es Salaam, and then Nairobi were hit. And then nothing else happened. So here we see another president so reluctant to take action on a world threat that is now menacing Europe, will make it, make it over to the United States. It's already been here. It'll come back again, doing nothing to disrupt this operation, saying, in effect, at the G20, which was a huge embarrassment, I think, to anybody who really cares about U.S. national security and the presence, the credibility, the prestige of the U.S. Military and leader of the free world, to hear a president saying that his approach to Syria is working. We just need more time. Well, they don't need more time in Paris, and we don't need another 9/11 here in the United States. Look, if Bush got a lot of things wrong, he got one thing right. You go after these people with the military, and you disrupt them in their safe havens. We have not done that under Obama, and now, we're seeing the effects of not going after them. So I think that this now becomes the major focal point in the presidential campaign. It's certainly in the halls of Congress right now, where they don't want to accept these Syrian refugees for good reason.
A good reason indeed, John. It's unfortunate. It's sad that these poor people, most of them, have to be turned around, or in most cases, states are saying, we don't want you, but there's no other choice, is there?
No, and this becomes the major pivot in the presidential politics right now, and this favors the Republicans very strongly. And I would say that if Obama keeps on the path that he's on and does not find the national security justification to go into Syria and Iraq with a coordinated force to start rooting these barbarians out, I think that this push, it tilts the balance to whoever the Republican candidate is in a year.
I think so. John's website, onlinecolumnist.com, the Canadian elected prime minister who'll take office soon has decided to pull Canada out of the bombing raids in Syria. Egyptian officials reportedly detained 17 airport employees hours after the head of Russia's security service said that the crash of that passenger plane over the Sinai Peninsula last month had killed all 224 people on board was indeed an act of terrorism. Reuters, citing two security officials, said an employee of the airport in a Red Sea resort area reported that 17 people were being held, but only two were strongly suspected of assisting whoever planted the bomb on that Metrojet airliner October 31st. And President Vladimir Putin of Russia has vowed to hunt down those responsible for blowing up that Russian airliner, and he will mean business. Putin has ordered the Russian Navy, for example, in the eastern Mediterranean to coordinate its actions on the sea and in the air with the French Navy, and they are going to use 37 planes to do whatever they need to do. Jim Sanders, of course, investigative journalist, author of The Downing of TWA Flight 800. Since the beginning, Jim and I have said that that plane was taken down by a bomb or a missile, and now the Russians are agreeing finally, James.
Right, and they found TNT on there somewhere on the plane, and I don't know what portion of the plane, and that seems to have been what got Putin going, and he's handled it brilliantly. His foreign policy is incredible. He's running circles around us.
I think so, too, and I think he means business, too. Once they find out a little bit more about this situation, I think he's going to unleash hell on these people.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he puts serious, as I hate to use the phrase because everybody uses boots on the ground. I would be absolutely amazed if he didn't go in there. He then is the Middle East is his center of power down to the south of Russia, and we're basically a non-player if he does that.
Jim, we always appreciate your feedback. You did a great job for us on the MH370 missing Malaysian plane and this one as well. Tragedy in Texas. Authorities investigating, and they have a suspect in custody after six people were found dead at a campsite in Anderson County, Texas. Unbelievable. People who drink coffee daily, even up to four cups a day, are less likely to die from heart disease, neurological disease, type 2 diabetes, or suicide than those who do not, according to a new study. What's up in the skies these days? Let's turn to Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Stephen, what do you got for us this week?
Well, George, an exciting morning for the coast audience. If you're looking to the eastern sky just before dawn, we're coming up right now at the peak time of the meteor shower, George, that so many people remember, the Leonids, and to see it, just take a look about 2 a.m. local time till sunrise. Hopefully your weather will be good, but what you should see is maybe 10 or 20 of these meteors moving across the sky from, of course, the namesake constellation Leo the Lion. They all come, George, from a constellation of, we mentioned, Leo, but a comet known as Comet 55P, the 55th comet, periodic comet called Temple Tuttle. And just for the record books, we know that a storm of meteors is when we see 1,000 meteors an hour. This one may be 10 or 20, but remember, back here in 1966, this is incredible, George. People saw this on the morning of November the 17th in Arizona and in the West. For about 15 minutes, we saw 40 to 50 meteors per second. That's over 2,500 meteors per minute, making it one of the biggest storms of all time. So the Leonids are historical. And don't forget, in closing, a really cool event on Thanksgiving morning, The full moon will cover up or eclipse the bright star, the eye of the bull, the star Aldebaran, and hopefully we'll be talking about that to give everybody a ringside seat information on how to see it. Great
Gosh,
stuff in the sky.
That's super. Stephen, you make looking up at the skies so much fun. A New Jersey mall has eliminated a requirement that parents pay $35 to $50 for a photo or a video package for their kids to get a little shot with Santa. Can you believe that? They were going to charge $35 to $50. Last year at the same mall, everything was free. People went ballistic this time, and they should, and they should. In a moment, we're going to talk about the annihilation of nature, human extinction of birds and mammals. Oh, my, what's this all about? Paul Ehrlich joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We've got lots going on for you tonight. We're going to start with Paul Ehrlich and his latest work, The Annihilation of Nature, and we're going to get into what that all means. Paul, of course, is the Bing Professor of Population Studies, the president of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University. He is the author of more than 40 books, including The Population Bomb and Human Nature's Genes, Cultures, and the Human Prospect. His latest work is The Annihilation of Nature. He co-authored that work with several other people, and he is on Coast to Coast. Paul, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Appreciate it.
Nice to be with you.
My gosh, close to 7 billion people on the planet. It keeps growing. But when you talk of the annihilation of nature, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think most people who follow what's going on are very concerned about climate disruption, which is already hurting us in many areas. And by the way, related to all this terrorist stuff that's going on. One of the things that we're doing that's at least equally serious is destroying our life support systems by wiping out the other organisms on the planet. As a government website said in response to some of the things that the Pope said very wisely, he said the one thing that the Pope didn't push on is how humanity is wiping out its life support systems. He said crowding out the rest of nature. We lost about half of the wildlife on the planet in the last few decades. And that's a tragedy because they're so interesting and beautiful and so on. But it's an even bigger tragedy because we owe our very lives to the plants, animals, and microorganisms of the planet, and we're getting rid of them. We're sawing off the limb that we're sitting on. So we wrote a book that should attract people to their beauty and interest and explain to them in detail basically what I just said and why I said it.
This annihilation, this elimination of creatures and animals, how's it happening? Because we're not systematically going out to try to do it directly. We're doing it indirectly, but what's happening?
Well, we're doing it indirectly by developing areas. Every time you see a mall going in or a road being paved or a forest being cut down, you're seeing the extinction of populations and sometimes of species. And we've had in the past 5 great mass extinction events when we lost most of the plants, animals, and microorganisms of the planet. And the last one was 66 million years ago when all the dinosaurs except for the birds bit the dust. And at that time, the cause was, as far as we can tell, an extraterrestrial object that hit the planet and basically caused a nuclear winter over the entire planet. The interesting thing is that mass extinction made it possible for you and me to be on this program, because at the time, the dinosaurs were ruling the world.
That's right.
The only mammals were little rat-like things dashing around and eating dinosaur eggs sometimes. But getting rid of the dinosaurs allowed those little mammals to evolve into Homo sapiens. Here we are. This time, we, as a product of a mass extinction, are causing a mass extinction. It's human beings, the actions of human beings, from climate disruption to paving over to spreading toxic substances and so on, are what's causing this mass extinction, and we're well into it already.
Paul, yet our human population continues to grow. At what point does that start reversing?
Well, again, you can't be certain, particularly in a world like today's world. For example, the experts who look at it carefully think the chances of a nuclear war between Russia and the United States are higher today than they were during most of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
The possibilities of a vast epidemic like Ebola not being contained and killing off most everybody increase with the size of the population. So there's lots of opportunities for sudden reduction in the size of the human population. But if not, probably the main cause of huge numbers of deaths and the end of the population explosion will come not from sea level rise, because you can walk away from that in most locations, but from what happens to agriculture, because we're already hurting the agricultural system. You never see this in the mass media, but of course, every person you add to the planet adds more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, and so worsens climate disruption. But every person you add to the planet means we got to grow more food or gather more food. And the biggest enemy of the climate is agriculture. About 30%
of the greenhouse gases that go into the atmosphere come from our food system. So it's a real circular thing. What we do, our growth of our population reduces the chances of our being able to feed the population in the future, and we're going at it hammer and tongs. So, I mean, again, about half of our military might, as you probably know, is engaged just in trying to see to it that oil keeps coming to it.
Of course.
Every scientist who knows anything about it says we got to stop burning the fossil fuels, including oil, as fast as possible. So, you know, fooling around in the Middle East to keep the oil flowing is like fooling around in the Middle East to keep cyanide flowing if we were hungry. But we just keep at it because, among other things, our politicians are largely ignorant of how the world works.
If we stay on this course, how do you see the next 20 years?
Well, my plan is to die.
Don't leave us too soon, huh?
But I see it going steadily downhill unless we have, you know, a very unlucky thing, like an accidental nuclear war between Russia and the United States, which is more than possible. The top expert on this is Theodore Postel at MIT, and anybody who wants to Google Postel and nuclear war can see a few-minute video that'll explain in some detail why it's getting more and more dangerous, the chances of an accidental nuclear war. And, of course, those chances themselves go up as tensions between us and the Russians get worse, as they may well, over current events, over problems with the Ukraine and so on. So, and, of course, the Indians and the Pakistanis almost want to have a nuclear war. The Mumbai terrorist attack is thought by many people to have been an actual attempt to start a nuclear war between those two countries. And the most recent studies indicate that a small nuclear war between India and Pakistan with maybe 300 or 415 kiloton bombs about the size of the Hiroshima bomb would end our civilization, too.
Oh, so, my God.
Not a pretty picture.
And I'm convinced, Paul, if an organization like ISIS ever gets a hold of suitcase nukes, that they will detonate them.
You are knowledgeable. Actually, it's interesting that about 15 years ago, when the Russians were in such bad shape that the guards who should have been guarding their nuclear weapons were picking potatoes because they weren't getting paid, a lot of people thought that that some of the Russian suitcase or backpack bombs might have gotten loose. I have to say that I'm slightly cheered by the fact that they didn't set one off in Paris. It indicates to me that they don't have one.
That's right.
In other words, people are really deeply nuts. And I would think every sign I've seen is if they had a nuclear weapon, we'd have lost a big city in the West by now. So that's what serves as cheery news today.
Eventually,
particularly since there's no big secrets about how nuclear weapons are made, the problem is getting hold of the materials. And I hope that all the Russian guards are well paid. And if I were the United States, instead of trying to make our nuclear weapons better for a first attack, I would be helping the Russians develop what we have, that is a spatial warning system, so that the chance of a accidental nuclear war would be greatly reduced.
Do you believe that our population, human population, is too high right now?
Well, I would say it's somewhere between 4 and 6 times. The studies vary, and the reason they vary is if you want to think about an optimum population, what lifestyle are they going to live?
Right.
In other words, if we want to live like the average American does, then we need another at least 3 or 4 planets to support us. If we want to live at bare subsistence level, then we might be able to eventually, in the long run, support, say, something on the order of 2 billion people to maybe even 3 billion.
So we're way over the limit then.
Oh, yeah. We're at 7.3 now and planning to add 4 billion more this century if we're lucky. And that means twice as many people will be added between now and the end of the century as existed on the planet when I was born in 1932.
Now, there's no way we're going to reduce the population by, you know, intelligent birth control or anything like that. That's just not going to happen. So what's the alternative?
Well, the alternative is something that half the population at least ought to be in favor of, and that is that what might do the trick, and it would take quite a while, is to give women full equal opportunity jobs and so on everywhere. We know that brings down birth rates. Then give everybody access to modern contraception and safe backup abortion.
Hold on, Paul. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more with you about the annihilation of nature next. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Paul Ehrlich with his book, The Annihilation of Nature. Paul, at what point in your life, in your career, did you start seeing a problem with overpopulation and what was happening to some of our species, our animals?
Well, I was very lucky in that I was born at the right time and went to college with veterans, the last veterans of the Second World War, who introduced me to a lot of things that they were concerned about, and to books by William Vogt and Fairfield Osborne about the environmental problems and the role population growth was playing in them, particularly population growth. And then I saw, I was working even in those days with butterflies, and I saw their habitats being paved over in New Jersey, and I found I couldn't raise their caterpillars because so much DDT had been sprayed around to try and knock off mosquitoes that you couldn't raise butterflies anymore. And so I really got interested in it when I was an undergraduate, when I was, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, and then I became professionally involved. So I've been at it a long time.
You sure have.
83 now.
Somewhere along the line, you've looked at this, and I think you've come to some conclusions that at the current rate, we are in a shocking position of eliminating not only lots of nature, but ourselves.
That's right. We're certainly eliminating our civilization. I'm in the middle of a debate with another member of the National Academy over the chances of avoiding a collapse. And weirdly, I'm the optimist in the group, Ann and I, basically, because Ann, all my work I do with my wife, Ann.
Mm-hmm. She's one of your co-authors in this book.
Yeah, right. One of the co-authors on the annihilation of nature, which, by the way, I should say, I love to promote because I don't make a nickel out of it. We paid for the beautiful illustrations, but we're giving all the royalties to training young conservation biologists who are trying to turn this situation around. But Ann and I have felt that the odds of avoiding a collapse are about 10%. That is, and a large portion of that is, will we actually try and do anything about it? In other words, will you ever hear, for instance, on the mass media that we have too many people in the United States and the world? But Jim Brown, who's the an energy expert and the top biogeographer in the world, says you're crazy. It's only about a 1% chance of avoiding a collapse. Well, I'm willing to work hard to make it 11%, and Jim's willing to work hard to make it 1.1%. Neither of us really knows any more than anybody else does how soon the collapse will occur, because the things like we just talked about, what are the chances that Al-Qaeda will get hold of a suitcase bomb and will be moved into a nuclear war, for example. So we'll see, but I don't like running the experiment.
China has just doubled its population plan from one child per family to two. Why did they do that?
Well, they have a lot of internal problems with it, and actually what we know about their society and so on, it's not going to make a huge difference in the number of people. They're already, of course, vastly overpopulated. They're, you know, while the problem isn't mentioned in the United States, places like China, Saudi Arabia, Korea, and so on are buying land in Africa because they know they're not going to be able to feed their people off of the land they've got. And so they're going to screw over Africans or other people in the tropics, buy land, and hope to be able to continue to farm it and send the food,
back out.
Home.
Jeez.
It won't make a big difference in China's population size because they've already moved into the kind of situation, a lot of them, that we have in Europe and North America, where family sizes are shrinking rapidly for other reasons. But it's going to make a big issue of what's sometimes called moral hazard. That is, It's like the people who think we're going to take DNA and recreate nature after we've destroyed it, or people who think that that if the Chinese can give up population control, that they can have as many babies as they want and not worry about it. In other words, it sends exactly the wrong message. But they've been in tough shape politically over it for some time. They have a lot of minority groups. They are very uneven. They have adopted the Ronald Reagan's Hood Robin program over there, too. The idea Robin Hood stole from the rich and gave to the poor, and the Hood Robin program does what we do in the U.S. and steal from the poor mm-hmm. and give to the rich. And the Chinese are moving in the same direction, and, the rich Chinese are now buying up places like San Francisco and Vancouver and Victoria.
Oh, yeah.
So they have the problems of those inequalities. And I actually, I have worked a lot, not a lot, but some in China. And I remember one of my Chinese female colleagues over there saying about 4 years ago that she had two kids, but what she'd done is gone to Japan to have the second one. So if you got enough money, you can dodge almost anything.
Well, I've always been concerned that this disparity between the haves and the have-nots continues to get wider and wider, and it's going to come to a breaking point where those that don't have are going to do something about it.
Yeah, I don't think the Koch brothers think their heads are going to look great on pikes, but that's where they're going to end up if we're not lucky.
People are going to get to that point, Paul, sooner than later.
Well, sure. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when it looked like you could live the American dream, that everybody could have a decent life and so on. And now, for the first time in a very long time, most Americans think their kids are going to have worse lives than they had. And it's because we've basically been stealing from them for a long time, stealing from our children, using up resources without considering the need for them in future generations. For example, we know the groundwater of the planet is shrinking fast enough to cause seismic events. And when you pump out too much groundwater, very often the geological formations change or salt water comes in and they can't even be recharged. And we are desperately necessary in many parts of the world to have groundwater to keep civilization going. We're running out of soil. We're toxifying the entire planet. I think it's generally considered by scientists that there's a real chance that that human beings are not getting smarter genetically, but getting dumber. And the reason is that every time you do a study, if you study, for instance, the IQ of kids who live downwind of the smelter versus upwind, there's usually about a 5-point advantage to those that live upwind, and that goes for all kinds of pollutants. We also are layering the earth with tiny little spheres of plastic. Some of it results from the plastic we dump in the ocean being ground up, but a lot of it is now in places like your skin cleaners and your toothpaste and so on, and those little spheres collect toxic chemicals on them, and some of them are small enough to cross the blood-brain barrier and get into your brain.
Jeez.
And again, nobody has done it's very difficult to even think of how to design a study over whether humanity is getting dumber. I think the only evidence I've seen is the Republican debates, but that's not really solid science.
Throwing a little politics our way, Paul, aren't you?
Well, I think everybody's got to get involved in politics, and I don't have any great love of either political party.
I was going to say, neither party is showing me any great plan.
Yeah, presidential candidate who's considered a leading presidential candidate who thinks the pyramids were built for grain storage, you're in deep trouble.
Well, we all know the extraterrestrials made them, Paul.
Yeah.
Hey, so let me ask you this. As we come to Thanksgiving next week, do we have anything to be thankful for? I mean, based on everything...
We're thankful that we haven't collapsed yet, and that we haven't, for example... it's a near miracle that we haven't had a nuclear war. A lot of people, I was scared witless in the late 40s. I remember having nightmares. I woke one night, there'd been an enormous clap of thunder. I was living in suburban New York, and I thought that an A-bomb had exploded
this
over
was
New
it.
York.
Yeah.
We were really scared in those days, even though the risk is enormously higher today. We didn't know that at the time. So we haven't had a nuclear war. That's to be thankful for. We don't treat our women or our minorities right, but we treat them a hell of a lot better than we did when I was a kid.
Sure.
For example, my first girlfriend, she actually had a TV set in 1938. Her father worked for Philco. You should have seen what a TV set was.
Which
like
was part of Ford Motor Company, wasn't it, at the time?
They became one of the big companies. I don't remember which, but the TV set was the size of a refrigerator and had a screen the size of a Coke bottle.
Yeah.
But what were her opportunities? In 1938, she could grow up to be a school teacher in a lower grade, a secretary or a nurse. That was about it.
Or a stay-at-home mom.
And yeah, right? Exactly. And I, you know, I'm an instrument-rated pilot. I took my instrument training from a woman pilot. And now on many airliners, of course, you have what most people in those days thought would be impossible, namely female captains. And I can remember when Jackie Robinson broke into the major leagues, there was huge, you know, first black player. There were huge discussions of whether or not people with dark skins could play in sports. The only sport in which they functioned really when I was a kid was in boxing. And when Joe Louis was the champion, and, you know, journals like the New York Times could write, "We need a white hope." In other words, their race was made an issue. So we've come a long way and often in the right directions. The problem is not fast enough. We've managed to, you know, we're a small group animal trying to live in groups of billions. And with nuclear weapons, I wish we had taken it a little slower on the destructive side and a little faster on the give everybody a decent life and a decent break side.
Paul, conspiracy buffs would say, and this is fascinating because I think you would agree, maybe not how they would get to it, but in the number, they say that the population of the planet should be 500 million, not 7 or 8 or 9 billion, but 500 million. They don't give us the plan on how to get down to that number, but what do you think of that?
Well, I think that we'd have a much nicer planet, and the other organisms on the planet, our life support systems, would be a lot safer if we had that. And again, with what I said before about women's rights and use of contraception and safe backup abortion, could move us slowly in that direction. We might want to stop around a billion, maybe 500 million, maybe 1.5 billion. Around the turn of the last century, around 1900, there were less than 2 billion people on the planet. And we still had, at that time, big cities where you could have a wonderful time and a concert and a great restaurant and real wilderness. If you wanted to be a hermit, you could be a hermit. So my idea of an ideal population would be down in that range where everybody would get a choice, where they could pick your own lifestyle, basically, and have the opportunity. And also, you could have more people live, because the idea that every person who can possibly be born has to live now and then wreck the life support systems, I'd like to see a world in which Homo sapiens and some descendant of our civilization goes on for a million years, not see how many you can have in the next 30 years and then let the whole thing collapse and have no more people on the planet.
Would we ever get to a point where they would have like a lottery, and if you lose, you get, extinguished?
Well, you know, there's all kinds of ideas. Every time I talk about any of the ideas other people have put forth, I'm claimed to be an advocate of them. Again, my main way of doing it would be what I said. But one of the things that several of us discussed in the literature, which was not suggested by me, was wouldn't it be great if you could add some chemical to the water supply that would make people take an antidote before they could have a child? And everybody said, "Oh, that's terrible. That's ghastly. Take an antidote before you could have a child." Well, yeah, that would be in some senses nasty. On the other hand, it would get rid of the abortion problem. It would get rid of the unwanted child problem. If you think about it, it might be biologically not possible or likely, but it would be a nice world if everybody could decide when they were going to have a child and not have a big random element in it.
Well, as horrible as it sounds, eventually something's got to be done, because we're starting to see right now, just in this country, over the controversy of the refugees from Syria, primarily because of the ISIS situation and what happened in Paris. But, you know, I've got a guest on, his name is Frosty Wooldridge, And he said, we cannot handle the amount of people who are coming into this country anymore.
I think I've followed his stuff, and I think he's right. In other words, we can, for good evidence is, for example, that we haven't been able to rally the capital to fix our infrastructure. We got bridges falling into rivers, bridges falling into roads. I live in one of the truly rich areas of the country, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Our roads are turning more and more into the kind of potholes I was used to when I was driving in fieldwork in Costa Rica. We are converging in many ways on the poor countries because we are trying to mobilize money to take care of more and more and more people and create more and more consumption, and not realizing that to have a world in which you can even enjoy whatever level of consumption you have to have infrastructure.
Well, let me tell you what I think is going to happen. I think that our power grid's going to go down one day because nobody's insulating it against an X flare from the sun or an EMP attack, a nuke detonated in the atmosphere. It's going to shut down the power system. 90% of the Americans will die. God knows what will happen worldwide.
Weirdly, I totally agree with you.
That's going to happen.
That is, again, evidence of why I tend to be pessimistic. In other words, this is not a mysterious problem. 125 years ago, roughly, we had such an event.
Yes.
We know exactly how to fix it. It wouldn't be incredibly expensive. But most people don't realize, for instance, say, I saw we lose the electricity for a while. What the hell? If you blow out all the transformers, you don't just lose the electricity. You lose the ability to pump gasoline. And so,
or get money out of your ATM or anything.
Right. So you're optimistic when you say 90% of Americans would die. I think it'd be higher than that. Because, among other things, people think food comes from the supermarket, yet our agricultural system is utterly dependent on pumped fossil fuels and electrical drying and refrigerators and communication systems and so on, all of which would be screwed up. And, once you eat what's in the local stores, that's it. You start eating each other.
Yeah, I'm a believer, by the way, in the abiotic oil theory, that this planet has oil, always did, but that doesn't mean we should be burning it.
That's right. And again, the whole shift away from fossil fuels is possible, but we're not doing it. In other words, we know we can make that kind of shift from what we did. You wouldn't remember, but I do, December 1941. Up to that time in that year, we produced almost 4 million cars, and we just changed everything overnight when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
Yep.
Stopped making cars, started making tanks and planes, started a program that developed and deployed nuclear weapons, rationed all sort of stuff,
And you made it happen.
Yeah, I mean, my parents saved their red points so they could feed my grandparents one roast beef one night.
I'm not sure we have the determination, Paul, to do that anymore.
Well, that's why I'm a pessimist. I don't think we do.
All right, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break, and we're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you. Paul Ehrlich, our guest, The Annihilation of Nature. What do you think about that? Chime in and call us with a question or two. I'm George Norrie, and we will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.